Welcome to Alpha Trader, a new month starting with markets looking to recover from last week's rate-induced sell-off, which saw the NASDAQ fall nearly 5%, while the Dow lost 1.7%, the S&P fell 2.5%. This week features the February jobs report, earnings from major retailers like Target and Costco, as well as Zoom and Neo and a handful of others. The president's $1.9 trillion stimulus bill has passed the House and now moves to the Senate. Lawmakers look to finish the aid package before March 14th, when some federal unemployment assistance expires. Also, Fed Chair Jerome Powell speaking again. What will he say? What can he say about the recent rise in Treasury yields? Joining us now to talk about all that and more, Steve Sosnick is Chief Strategist at Interactive Brokers. Steve, welcome back to Alpha Trader.
Thanks very much, Aaron. Very glad to be here.
Great to have you here. We were talking before the bell on Monday. Futures are pointing to a strong open to the week, at least the start of the day. So was that it? Is the great rate freakout of 2021 over? Was that it for the sell-off? Or what's your short-term outlook here for the market?
Short-term outlook is it's not surprising to see a rally today. You know, if I told you in absentia that one of the houses of Congress was going to pass a giant fiscal stimulus bill, and you'd get a new vaccine approved that can be rolled out as early as this week, what would you think? Plus, it's the first of the month, which, you know, I haven't looked at the Trader's Almanac in quite a while, but that's, you know,
usually a good thing, right? Right.
You know, things. So you combine the three, you know, the fiscal stimulus, not news. The vaccine, honestly, did anyone think it was not going to get approved? But sure, this is, you know, these are good pieces of news. You know, it's not unreasonable. Plus, oh my gosh, we had a down week, so therefore we must start this new week up, and off we go. But you know, I'm looking at the bond market. I guess we're all us equity traders are bond traders right now. You know, I'm starting to see the bonds tick higher in yield, lower in price, and if that becomes a freakout, then stocks will eventually follow along. But right now, yeah, why not? Let's start the morning with some enthusiasm.
Let's do it. And you mentioned a reference. It was J&J's COVID vaccine was approved over the weekend by the FDA. And it's fridge stable for 3 months and requires half the dose of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. So that's very positive. And you know, again, giving people, this is the rationale for the rise in yields, that we have this huge stimulus package. The Fed's pledge to stay at zero for the foreseeable future, and the economy could boom this year. So it makes sense for rates to rise. And, you know, of course, it's about the rate of change in yields. Last week, you know, you had that big spike up, which really scared some people. The 10-year got to 1.6%, around 1.4 as we're talking here Monday morning again. Is this going to be the big dynamic that we're going to be talking about, do you think, for the next 3 to 6 months? Like, how fast is the economy going to grow, and how high are bond yields going to go, and how quickly will they get there?
You know, I mean, bonds and stocks have a fluky relationship. I mean, they used to actually diverge for a while, because, you know, that's the whole point of the 60-40 portfolio, right? Is when, you know, one protects the other. I mean, to show my age a little bit, when I started in the business was, you know, I was in the training class at Salomon Brothers. It was 1987, auspicious time. And, you know, I remember that being one of the absolute grinding bear markets for bonds. You know, it's like, how can the stocks keep going up and ignoring the bond market? And eventually, in about one day, they noticed. But so, you know, right now, they're tied together much more explicitly because they're all dependent upon the Fed. You know, I don't want to be one of these guys who's, although the Fed's got their hand in everything. But the Fed does have their hand in everything. Ask yourself the question, would stock or bond rates be where they are if the Fed wasn't, you know, if the Fed wasn't doing what it was doing? Let me not be pejorative in any way.
Right.
So they're very much tied together. You know, the Fed has explicitly tied their accommodation to the return of some combination of full employment and inflation. And at least in the short term, the commodities are telling you, you're getting some inflation. On the labor side, not as clear, especially with the Senate not taking up the minimum wage, but that's a whole other argument. I mean, if I were a politician, I would rather have the thing indexed than just pick a number that you're going to have to renegotiate in a few years, but so be it for me. That's my political talk for this morning. But, you know, but that's, so the market is worried, because if the Fed you know, there's like, I'm going to call it the pre-taper tantrum. They're not tapering yet. We don't even, you know, Powell, and we'll find out more this week, you know, what they feel about it. But the markets are, you know, when you've got markets priced to perfection, as I would argue they are, anything that can upset the current motif is enough to get people a little bit edgy. And that's, I think, the, you know, in the 10-year is the way to gauge that edginess.
I know Stephen wants to jump in here, but I mentioned earlier, Powell is speaking. You just referenced it before. I was being a little flip, like, but is there anything you think he's going to say differently than what he just said last week in front of Congress and what the Fed has been saying? As, you know, what's the odds at this point that he's going to surprise the markets here?
99-1 against.
Okay. I mean, okay. Yeah.
I can't imagine he's going to. He went to great lengths in his congressional testimony to paint a picture. Unless there's a really crafty journalist who can, you know, come up with a great question that can do the gotcha and get him off balance. I think he's pretty clear where he stands right now.
Yeah. And I would just point out that this isn't your daddy's bond market sell-off. 10-year yield bottomed at about 0.5% in August. It rose as it should have as the economy came out of lockdown. Yes, it spiked up to 1.6 for a little bit last week after a bad treasury auction, quickly kind of fell back down. It's about 1.44 as we speak this morning. This is a really modest rise of rates. This isn't several hundred basis points like you were talking about 1987. We can go back to 1994. You can go back to some of the moves in the 70s and the early 80s as well. Those were real bad bond market moves that surely sucked money out of stocks and into fixed income. I think last week, everything was very perky across the board, whether it be stocks, whether it be commodities, copper, soybeans, corn, oil, Bitcoin, everything was just through the roof. Everything needed to cool down a bit. And, you know, we've had kind of these bond market scares, it seems, once a year ever since 2009. I call it a rite of spring. It's more of a rite of winter where, okay, this year, growth is coming back in a strong way. Inflation is coming back in a strong way. And the Fed's going to start, you know, jacking up rates. And it just never happens. And right now, I'm not seeing anything differently this year.
I think you're right. I mean, if I told you, you know, markets would freak out because they, all things being equal, they, you know, let's put in absolute terms that because the 10-year rate would creep up by half a percentage point from one very low level to another, what are we freaking out about? But the problem is we're so stretched. You know, the only way you can justify a lot of the equity valuations that you have is if you discount their, pick your metric of choice, your revenues, your earnings, your, I don't know, whatever, you know, your mind share, your eyeballs, whatever one you want to use. But if you discount it at essentially a zero rate, well, you can put on any valuation you want. If you're actually, you know, trying to value a company and you have to put in an actual interest rate. Now, granted, there's still negative real interest rates. So let's be clear here. I think just people are freaking out about, you know, a little bit of acrophobia, a little fear of heights. But I think that's where you get into the kookiness, right? Is just this free flowing money, both from monetary and fiscal stimulus. It's finally starting to do something in the goods market. You know, as you mentioned, we're seeing the commodity price inflation, commodity prices rise. You know, eventually that does make it into finished goods if it stays. You haven't really seen labor cost inflation because, you know, the labor economy is still too slack for that. But you could look 6 months down the road and make a case that, you know, a lot of the jobs will come back. And so I can really argue that while what we're seeing in the bond market now is really relatively tepid, remember that all the inflation we've seen more or less for the past decade has been asset price inflation. And, you know, I think anything that upsets that, just, you know, people get a bit nervous. You know, that said, you alluded to Bitcoin. You know, that thing's had a $5,000 range, almost a $6,000 range while most people were asleep. So right. There's a lot of kooky stuff out there.
Yeah, I would agree with both of you about the bond markets. Just the one thing that did get my attention last week is that the yield in the 10-year at one point, I don't know if it still is actually, was higher than the dividend yield in the S&P 500 for the first time in a while. Right. So that is something that you can point to say, okay, you know, maybe the valuations have gotten stretched too far. for stocks broadly. And now bonds are providing some kind of competition. So the Tina argument gets a little bit harder to make, right? There is an alternative.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I would say the alternatives are still slim pickings, but they're not necessarily as slim as they were. And I guess that's part of it.
Yeah. The other thing that just struck me on bonds is how out of whack what's going on in the U.S. Versus the rest of the Western world. In Germany, the 10 years, negative 30 basis points. Japan, it's 15 basis points. Even in Spain, the 10-year yield is 36 basis points. So the U.S. 10-year yield is right now kind of towering, not just over the S&P 500, but over every other kind of developed country yield. Is it that those central banks are much more active at the long end, or is it that those economies are just so much lamer than what's going on in the U.S.?
Some and some. You know, I mean, I saw a story today that the German banks basically are actively telling people, stop giving us money. You know, remember, of course, that the, you know, historically, the German public has had a lot less of a taste for riskier investments than the U.S. public. I think that's somewhat reflected. You know, Japan shorting the JGB is like, you know, one of the classic widowmaker trades. You keep waiting for the thing to, you know, to break, but it never does because the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, has a huge, you know, has a huge footprint on the market, which, by the way, is my counter argument to when people say, you know, see, low rates are sufficient to justify great valuations. And no, because, you know, Japan has had low rates for 30 years and it finally took them all this time to get back to their peak that they saw, you know, in 1990, basically. So I think there are structural differences in the way each central bank approaches it, and the way each country approaches it, in the way each country's investors approach it. I do think at some point you start to converge, but I think also people are betting on the fact that the U.S. is going to come out of this faster than Europe and probably faster than Japan. And so that's being reflected in the bond markets.
Right, so turning back to the implications this has for the stock market, Goldman Sachs had a note out either late last week or over the weekend, you know, talking about how shifting interest rates, quote, have major implications for rotations within the equity market. As rates have risen, the contribution of equity duration to stock values has declined, while near-term growth profiles have become more important. Practically, this means that both the improving growth outlook and rising rates have supported the outperformance of cyclicals and value stocks relative to stocks with the highest long-term growth, end quote. So basically, they're saying that the rotation out of some of the high-flying mega-cap tech stocks and the NASDAQ broadly into value, cyclical stocks, energy, and financials specifically is justified and likely to continue. And that, to me, says that what we're seeing, or what we've seen the last several months, is a healthy rotation in an ongoing bull market as opposed to the end of something, which a lot of people are pointing to. Do you have a view on that?
Well, first of all, I know you got a good gig now, but I think if you decide to change being a translator of Goldman Sachs research reports is a good.
If I can get that gig, I'll take it. I'll take it.
Yeah. Because I mean that, you know, I mean, why couldn't it just say that?
Right. You know, I know.
Which is okay. So basically, it's basically saying, all right, the idea of valuing, you know, cash flows out into infinity at zero is ending. We're going to have to start valuing them. So you're going to look to things where, you know, that are more leveraged to the economy than to the hereafter. And, you know, the one thing they didn't mention, which I find it, you know, of course, interesting is banks, which are the literal beneficiaries of a steeper yield curve.
Yep.
Because their business model really, you know, as much as you strip away all the other stuff, it's, you know, borrow short, lend long, and manage the duration risk. So that's a fancy way of saying that we're going to see a different crop of winners and losers over the next few months as the reopening trade comes into play. I mean, I don't disagree with the sentiment, but boy, that was a wordy way.
It was a wordy way to put it. And I probably should have summarized it more clearly, but you know, so just some numbers around that, you know, since November, the S&P 500, the financial sector is up 29%. The energy sector is up 65%. Again, both of them after, you know, terrible relative and absolute performance in recent years. The S&P is up 9% in that time frame. The Russell 1000 value index has gained 16.5%. So this is happening. The small cap Russell 2000 is up 34%, right? So I guess, you know, again, what is your point of view on this idea that, is this the start of something, as John Markman, our guest last week, has basically said, or the last gasp, you know, blow off top kind of move, and, you know, before the end of something, as other people are arguing? What's your view on that?
I'm closer to the latter view. And I just, you know, I've seen markets get stretched like this, and it at this point, you know, you require an ever increasing amount of external stimuli to keep the markets where they are. Requirements of this market are continued monetary stimulus and the hope of more fiscal stimulus. I think in terms of fiscal stimulus, we're done for a while. You know, there might be an infrastructure bill. That's the governmental equivalent of vaporware. You know, it's been talked about forever.
It's Infrastructure Week, right?
Yeah, it's
Infrastructure Week. Right now.
You know, and the same people who were, you know, ultimately that I could see that one getting through at some point, because you know, no politician likes anything more than to bring home pork to their district.
Right, of course. Yeah.
And so, you know, which is ironic, listening to the people on TV complaining this weekend. Well, you know, it's not all going to be spent now. It's going to be spent over years, and it involves like tunnels in New York. It's like, that's the whole point. Is that is infrastructure. That's where I want the money spent.
Yeah, and that has economic benefits, right? Long-term economic benefits. That's a good use of our taxpayer dollars, I would argue. And most economists would agree.
I wrote something about this, that, you know, do we get a sugar rush, or do we get like, you know, real nutritious food? And the problem is the markets and the politicians both kind of agree that they like the sugar rush. And secondly, you know, one of the things that's really benefited this market is the amount of savings that people have accumulated. If you're lucky enough to have kept and had a job and maintained it and kept it through this, and not everybody has, I fully recognize that, but the majority of people have. And that money, which has been going into savings and a lot of it into the markets, is going to start coming out. We're all going to do it. We all want to travel. We all want to go to shows or to restaurants or whatever it is we did before. We want to do it again. And, you know, I think you're going to see dis-savings as people spend their money. By the way, I do have to believe that, you know, whatever hotel you liked going to, you know, down the shore or whatever it is for the last couple of years, probably going to be more expensive this summer, because everybody's going to be trying to go to the same hotel. Everybody's going to be trying to get on a plane. I think that, you know, both argues for a bit more inflation, and it argues for money for some of the, you know, you take out the fiscal leg of the stool and you start to see some dis-saving. Yes, it's good for the economy, but not necessarily good for stock prices.
Okay. We're going to take a short break to hear from our sponsor, CME Group. We'll be right back with more from Steve Sosnick. This is Alpha Trader. We're back with Alpha Trader and our guest, Steve Sosnick.
And I wanted to see if we could turn the discussion to something you've been talking and writing about quite a bit lately, and that's volatility. And you wrote about the VIX futures curve as giving you a pretty nice sell signal ahead of last week. And now that the market has sold off, maybe that curve isn't telling you quite as much. I was wondering if you could speak about that a bit.
Oh, you got a couple hours. I can talk about volatility forever.
Give it all to us in about 30 seconds or less.
This is the beauty of the podcast. Yeah, there's no time limit, but yeah, I'll try to summarize.
Please. No, I understand. What I wrote about early last week was the VIX futures curve, which basically, if you're not familiar with it, is, you know, VIX. There are futures that trade on the VIX index, the Cboe Volatility Index. And, you know, when you graph each of the sequential futures, it looks like a yield curve. It is upward sloping as you go left to right, you know, somewhat convex, you know, somewhat of, you know, convex nonlinear rise. And, you know, we use that to see the future expectations of future volatility. Because one thing, by the way, and I do want to be clear about this, and this is one of the misnomers about VIX, is VIX isn't telling you what today's volatility is. VIX is telling you what today's traders think that volatility will be in 30 days using the implied volatility of options that have an average of 30 days till expiry. So even the spot VIX is a 30-day look ahead. So then when you go out to like the March, or, you know, we're in March now, but let's, when you go out to April or May, you're looking at where traders think volatility will be 30 days from that future date. So there's a lot of moving parts in there, but bottom line is that's what we use to see like future expectations of volatility. For example, in the summer and late and early fall, we saw a very, very steep VIX futures curve, basically starting around October. The rationale for that was what was in the 30 days following the middle of October when those futures expired, the election. And so we were very, you know, it was very clear why the markets would have this, you know, the steepness to it, because there would be some volatility around the election and then the days ensuing. And we did get it. And by the way, upside moves do count as volatility. A lot of people forget that, but that's
right.
Volatility is agnostic.
It's movements in any direction, right? It's
just movement. You know, if you believe VIX is purely the fear index, which it's not, it just happens to work that way much of the time. But volatility is strictly movement, and we got movement. And so what I noticed last week was that the VIX futures curve was about as steep as it was before the election. And which raises the question, what are people so fearful about going into April and May? Because there's no, you know, in September, you know, in August, September, October, I could tell you why we were so steep. It was very obvious. It was plain as day. Now it's a lot more, it was a lot murkier. The reason I keep talking about it in the past tense is because, you know, at that point, the you know, let's say the April VIX futures were about, you know, 29-ish, and the spot, you know, and the spot contract was like 22, 23. The spot was at like 22, 23. As the week went on, the futures kind of did nothing. The longer term futures kind of did nothing. They actually declined slightly depending on the month, while spot rose. So now you had a very flat curve as we ended the week. And so my question became, what are the markets so nervous about? What do they see? What do they see down the pipe? What do volatility traders see down the pipe that may not be reflected in equity markets themselves? And it's an open question. And, you know, I saw the steepness as being a potential sell signal, and it, you know, meaning we were a little sanguine in the front and a little nervous in the back, and they've kind of equalized that now. But what does that mean going forward? And what are the markets? What are the markets still so nervous about? And, you know, I've tried to come up with some hypotheses for that.
Yeah. Before we get to the answer, first of all, I want to, you know, tip my hat to you, because there were a lot of people talking about this before the election, maybe because it was obvious and people like to talk about politics. I didn't hear anybody else talking about this in the last week or so. So that was, you know, for people who read your commentary, you know, that was a great heads up for people. So kudos to you on that.
IBKR Traders Insight or tradersnews.com. That's
there you go. Yes, thank you. And I'll reiterate, you know, we're talking before the open on Monday, and the spot is, you know, indicated to be down 10%+ back into the mid-20s. So is, again, and almost, you know, echoing what I asked you at the top of the podcast, like, was that it? Like, is that fear gone now? Or is it still, you know, the steepness still there enough that you're concerned, that the market's concerned about something in the next couple of months?
Well, if we open where I think we will, you know, what the futures are telling me now, because the futures are live and trading, it's literally back to the same pattern they were last week. You know, with the short, you know, with not quite, I guess I'm overstating it, but we're not quite as steep because the outer months have come down a bit. But it's not as extreme, and it's still telling you that we're not out of the woods. And so you start to look, you know, what would do that? What are the macro factors that would come into play? And we've discussed a whole bunch of them, you know, the strengthening of the economy, potentially.
Rates, obviously.
Savings. Yeah. But I think that, you know, first of all, there's a seasonality, right? You know, we've all heard the phrase, sell in May and go away. And so when you start to see April VIX being one of the points where people are a bit more nervous, remember, it's looking 30 days out. So mid-April, you know, they're actually somewhat late April because of the expiration cycle. And then what covers that? Well, that's your sell in May period. And there's another big one that I think people are not focused on. And what does everybody do on April 15th? Taxes.
Yeah.
And I think this year you're going to have a very interesting tax situation because you have a huge rate, you know, a huge amount of new investors in the market. The vast majority of them have done really well for themselves. And you know, this is not going to be one of these, oh, you know, see, I'm going to be the, you know, I'm going to be the suit waving my finger at the regular guy. No, no, no. But what I think, you know, if you've been the regular guy invested fully up till now, and you've been trading actively, as many have, you have taxes you're going to have to pay in April. And you're going to have to get that money from somewhere. And presumably that money is going to come from your investments that you're fully invested in now. That, I think, is a risk. I think the virtuous cycle of more and more savings, more and more coming into the market, is going to have a little bit of a hiccup as we get into you know, April and beyond. The virtuous cycle at least breaks temporarily as we see some of that dis-saving.
Steve, so sticking on the VIX, and I know you can get really deep into the weeds on this, but I saw a note last week from JP Morgan basically arguing that the VIX is in a bubble, that it's elevated. And, you know, if it would quote unquote normalize, you know, that's really bodes well for the equity market. What is your take on that?
A couple of disclaimers before I go into it. First of which is I haven't actually seen the report. I've only seen reporting on the report.
Same.
And secondly, yes. I have nothing but the greatest respect for Marko Kalanović as a quantitative analyst, who's really one of the best in the business. And having said that, I disagree with him. And I think
what makes markets, right? Yeah, that's what makes markets.
Yeah, I think he's missing two very key elements to how traders who do this all the time, you know, think about the volatility. And first reason is, and this is something I've written about, is the nature of the VIX calculation. The calculation hasn't changed really, but the nature of the options that go into it have. And gosh, I hate saying this time it's different, but there's a function, there's something in here that you have to recognize. And one of the features is the VIX calculation is basically they're taking a range of options that have a volatility, a time to expiration averaging about 30 days. You know, and I think it's, I forget what it is offhand, it's maybe 23 to 37 days or something like that. And every option that has a bid greater than zero. So that means you have a lot of wings being priced in, wings being out of the money puts and out of the money calls. And so you take your at money options, which is your implied versus versus historical, your at money. And then you basically throw in the fact that the out of the money puts have tended to have a higher price relative to at money's. It's skew. And that's been the case since the 87 crash. Skews actually used to be relatively flat. And then the market kind of woke up and realized in October, this portfolio insurance thing where you can sell futures doesn't really work if everybody's trying to sell the same futures at the same time. And so, you know, I think a lot of the options market community realized they'd been underpricing volatility on the downside as demand changed and people realized that options were a better hedge than futures for your portfolio. And so you saw systemic demand for out of the money puts. And there's no real natural sellers of out-of-the-money puts. You got to be incentivized to sell them. So you see that steepness. That's always pushed VIX above historical. Countering against that, though not as strongly, has been the fact that the natural trade on the for out of the money calls has been writing them. You know, we've all done it, I'm sure.
Right.
And it's a popular strategy. But what we've seen over the last few months, call it a year, is all this new money flowing into call options, primarily newer investors, but, you know, SoftBank being the ultimate at when they were doing this. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, just as, you know, the sellers of the put options in 1987 realized they better start charging more. In 2020 and 2021, the writers of the call options realized we better start charging more. You know, the ultimate being the GameStop scenario where you know, the market makers got clobbered, not once, but yet again last week.
Yes, again last week, yeah.
Yeah, just, you know, redux. So I think, you know, obviously the normal situation is GameStop is an extrapolation of the extreme, but so you're starting to see the nature of a change because out of the money calls are not suppressing are not balancing out against the lift from out of the money puts. So you are seeing a sort of a systemic rise in VIX over the relationship between historical and the level implied by VIX. And so it's a little weird. I've written about it again, tradersinsight.news, but that's where we, you know, it's a bit strange, but that's one of the esoteric pieces of the calculation. I'm actually kind of surprised a quant of his stature didn't fully appreciate that. I'm going to argue that, you know, his argument may be that this is a fleeting thing. My argument is going to be traders have long memories, and as long as they can get away with charging more for out of the money calls, they will do so. And that's, I think, if not a permanent thing, a semi-permanent thing.
I was going to say, so, you know, obviously, you know, Marko Kolonovic is not here to, you know, argue this or defend himself. We'd love to have him on, talk about this. We could probably do several hours between the two of you, or just let you guys, you know, we'll roll out the balls, let you guys talk about the VIX. You could probably do that for days and days. I just want to be clear, like, what is your forecast for the VIX from here?
I think VIX stays firm. And I think, you know, because what we're seeing is, and this is another thing that goes against his argument, is because we've seen intraday moves, traders tend to price in the intraday moves. And so I think VIX remains, I think you're not going to see a sustained VIX below 20 for some time. And, you know, the reason for that is, you know, go back to Thursday, where you had basically, I think it was Thursday, we had the market, you know, markets were down, I guess it was Wednesday, sorry. Markets were down like 2+% and then essentially closed unchanged. If you're using historical volatility as being close to close, you would be throwing essentially a zero into your calculation. If you're looking at it from a point of view of what can I trade, if I'm long options, what's the decay, you know, can I monetize the gamma over the decay? Sorry. Can I trade the range that's higher than is being priced in? Then the markets are going to decay on me. Then the options are going to decay because options are a decaying asset. Or conversely, if I'm short, am I going to be subjected to moves greater than I've priced in? You want to be cognizant of the intraday move, not the close to close. And so historical is always a bit understated relative to VIX, because the traders are using the historical. So when you ask me for the prediction, unfortunately, there was a guy on Bloomberg Radio, and I tweeted it out, you know, got Brian Curtis in Bloomberg Radio Asia asked me this question Monday morning, the 15th, Hong Kong time. So we were actually closed. It was a Sunday night before holiday.
Before President's Day, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And he said, what's your, you know, VIX had closed at 1997. The prior day. And he said, what's your, you know, best thing? And he asked me the same question you did. And I was fortunate enough to say 30 before 15 on VIX. And we actually did get to over 30 on Friday. So the problem is now it's a little murkier. I'm still going to say 30 before 15. I'm going to go back to that same call with us around, you know, with us in the low 20s. It's not as juicy as it was before, where, you know, it was 5 points down and 10 points up. When we're doing this now, it's probably about 50, you know, 7 or 8 points in either direction. I still think you're going to see more firmness in VIX with a few panicky moments rather than a sustained grind lower. I think it's going to take a bit of work to get below 20 on VIX in a sustainable way.
I'm wondering if Nassim Taleb is going to run out of stuff to complain about. Hasn't he forever argued that tail risk is underpriced, that volatility is understated? And then it seems to me like you're saying there's kind of a secular change going on to kind of his view.
You know, the thing is, having spent most of my career making sure that a multi-billion dollar options portfolio didn't blow up, I was always sort of inherently on the Taleb side of the argument, because it was literally my job to make sure that we never were overexposed in a way, you know, and had any real trouble. And I think I did a pretty good job of that when we were active market makers. And that one of the reasons for that was you make sure you have some tail risk at all times. Now, not everybody has the difference between, you know, the situation that I ran as a market maker, where I had to be in the market every day. That's the definition of the job. Normal investors have the option of simply lightening up their exposure.
Right. Not particularly.
But, you know, I've always sort of biased myself toward the Taleb side, because I've been through enough cycles and I've seen there have been a lot of times that I could have, that we could have blown up, and we didn't. We tended to make money through those cycles because the tail risk was, you know, by owning the tail risk was saved us. But there's a cost to it. You know, you're buying insurance all the time, and as with most insurance, you're kind of hoping it. You know, you're kind of
never have to use it, right? You hope you never have to use it, right? So you mentioned tail risk, and I guess I'd feel like I'd be committing journalistic malpractice if I didn't ask you this question, because you also referenced 1987 a couple of times in this podcast. Do you see similarities between now and what we saw before the 87 crash, or is that just, you're just making a reference for historical purposes?
That was a reference more for historical purposes. The one I do see parallels to and is 1999 or 2000.
You do.
Yep. Mm-hmm. History doesn't repeat, but it often rhymes. And when we think about what was going on in the late 90s, you know, you had a technological wave of, you know, both financial and real world innovation. And the internet did change the world, you know, so they did get it right. But when you look at some of the winners from those days, very few of the winners in those days are still winners. The market got a lot of it wrong. They got really ahead out over their skis in a lot of names. I saw a chart today of, you know, the big winners, and, you know, VA Linux, you know, had the big, you know, 700% pop. Eventually they
did. Right.
The globe.com with a 600% one day pop, pets.com with a 200 or 300%. So you're seeing that, you're not seeing that in IPOs per se, but you're seeing that in SPACs. You know, I'm actually disappointed that none of the three of us have a SPAC, because
you know. Well, I'm moving on to NFTs, actually. That's like the new thing that I keep hearing about. So that's beyond SPACs. I'm going into the NFT world now.
Okay. All right. So you're one step ahead then.
You and Dan.
That's it. I'm never on the cusp of this stuff. But when you think about like 1999, one of the hallmarks was, first of all, you had a very accommodative Fed, because, you know, at the end of this technical, you know, as the markets were getting frothy because of the Y2K issue, now there the end was a bit more clear, because they realized that Y2K, once it passed, they stopped, you know, they started withdrawing liquidity, and that ended poorly. But in 1999, also, you had a huge sea change in the public getting invested. You could do it yourself. I mean, I don't know if you remember those commercials. I forget which of our editors it was, but you know, the young cool dude, you know, teaching the old dude how to buy stocks online.
It was a TD Ameritrade commercial.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and there was the Ameritrade commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was the tow truck driver. Stuart. Just did it for fun, right? Remember the tow truck driver for, I think it was E-Trade? You know, he was like, I just do this for fun, and he had his own island. Yeah, I remember that for sure.
Yeah, and so what do you have now? Well, you know, Robinhood made it, you know, is gamified in, you know, investing to a certain extent. And as an industry, you know, if you want more of something, make it free. We've made it free, you know, for stock investing. And And it's never been more in the 90s. It was never more accessible and never cheaper to be an investor. Now it's never been more accessible and never cheaper to be an investor. And each of those periods now versus then had a quantum leap in terms of access to new financial products, and new investors tend to get seduced by new technologies. And you can see, Bitcoin or Tesla, or, the type of winners that we have, the type of stuff that really galvanizes it. You know, also in the late 90s, you had a real big quantum leap forward in terms of investors being to communicate amongst themselves.
Yes.
Then it was, AOL and Yahoo chat rooms. And now it's, now it's Reddit. But, the game's the same. I mean, that game's been going, people have been talking their book for as long as they've had books, coffee shop in Amsterdam. I'm sure there were guys.
Oh yeah.
Tulip books, but, it's just made it all cheaper, easier, and faster. And I think we're seeing that now, and that's where I see the parallels. And so if, and when the Fed decides that we've seen enough, it could have, I hope it doesn't, but it could have similar consequences.
And speaking of speculation, we do have to quickly ask you about Bitcoin. Do you consider that kind of a legitimate emerging asset class, or is that kind of a 1999 style bubbly thing happening right now?
Both. I think as proof of concept for blockchain, I think it's important, and that's a huge advance. And the problem is the two get conflated. I think, blockchain is a move forward, and we haven't really figured out all the possible uses for it. And you're seeing it now. Again, think about the 90s. Some company would say, well, we're starting a website, or we're going to open an e-commerce site, and that was enough to propel their stock. And all the internet stocks, because, the internet was getting adopted. Okay, so now it's adopted. It's part of our lives. Blockchain, I think Bitcoin, as a proof of concept for blockchain, I think it's really cool. And I think there's going to be applications. If you want T plus zero in the settlement cycle in stock markets, you're going to need blockchain or something like it. Bitcoin itself, there's a lot of faddishness to it. And, I think it's very much the flavor. Can it go higher? Absolutely. Can it go lower? Yeah, sure. Making predictions about what Bitcoin does is a bit difficult. And, again, I think it's important to separate blockchain from Bitcoin. I think when you see all these corporations, adopt, and I'm not talking about Tesla, because I think there's a certain amount of pump and dump going on there, but not pump and dump, just pump. But I think, in terms of, Bank of New York saying they're going to, Mellon, saying they're going to be able to, they're adopting Bitcoin. No, they're responding to their customers. Their customers want it, so they want to do it. And it also brings them into the, also get them up to speed with blockchain type of stuff. And I think that's where the real point of it is. But as of now, it's certainly too volatile to be a currency. I mean, again, in the last 24 hours, we've had a $5,000 range. You can't have a real means of exchange that moves 10% while most people aren't even paying attention. So the Bitcoin is its own little animal. And, whoever the young people are in the business looking back at it however many years ago will take whatever lessons out of it. And they'll either be talking about how it, went to a million and everybody became zillionaires, or it went back to being sort of a financial sideshow. We won't know that right for a while.
Yeah, just to quote this headline from Citigroup this morning, Bitcoin is at a, quote, tipping point between mainstream boom and speculative implosion. So, it's a choose-your-own-adventure story right now. And obviously, much more to talk about in that future podcast, but we do have to wrap here. Our guest has been Steve Sosnick, Chief Strategist at Interactive Brokers. Steve, thanks again for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. I didn't even realize we've been talking this long. So that's a good thing.
Time flies when you're having fun. It has been great. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.